Today on Shipment from Shiloh, Dane joins me to brainstorm for alternative options for runner economy in the current card pool. We discuss different perspectives on deck building and competing in Netrunner. All this and more on Shipment from Shiloh. Howdy doody, neighbor, and welcome to Shipment from Shiloh, a Netrunner community podcast. I'm your host, Graham, and today I'm joined by one of the Netrunner greats, Dane. Dane, how you doing, man?
Doing great. How are you, Graham?
Great. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dane is joining me today to discuss some runner economy options, but before we get to that, I figured, hey, you, listener, you might want to know a little bit more about who this Dane guy is. And so we're going to do that in our first segment called Searchlight. So Dane, you've been around the Netrunner block for a little while now, yeah?
Yeah, I started about 5 years ago.
Okay. Well, the game's about 5.5 years old. So, you know, you didn't get quite in at the front door, but it was still like Genesis cycle, yeah? When you were starting playing?
I think when I started, there were 2 data packs out.
Wow. Okay. Now, how did you even hear about the game in the first place?
You know, I actually had a good friend that I would play. I don't know if I'm even allowed to say Magic. I know a lot of the other podcasts will call it the other game.
Ugh.
He and I used to cube Magic.
Mm.
Magic is actually a fun game. I just too poor
really?
To play it.
Wow.
And so, he and I would just kind of proxy cards or we'd buy, you know, cheap cards. We'd have a pauper cube. So he and I would play that. We both played it as kids. We both liked it. And so we would play that. And he was at the store, one of our local game stores, Cat and Mouse Games, and buying some cards, I think. And they're like, hey, Netrunner was originally designed by Richard Garfield. You know, you might be into this. And he bought it. And he's like, oh, this is kind of fun. He played it with me a couple times, and he actually cooled on it pretty quickly.
Hmm.
But I was hooked. Like after we played a couple games, he was like, you know, let's just play Magic when you come over. Like I prefer Magic to this. But I started going to the local meetups at Cat and Mouse and at the other game stores.
So coming from another card game, then what do you particularly like about Netrunner? What makes it stands out from other board games or card games for you?
You know, I think the thing that first drew me to it was that there's always an out.
Yes.
Magic has a lot of really interesting deck building choices and things like that, but a not insignificant number of games you play, you lose just by your first 7 cards.
Hmm.
You look at them and you say, there are 7 lands here, or there are 0 lands here.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it may take 15 minutes to shuffle out and you've lost, but you've lost it all the same.
Hmm.
From the beginning, it's just a done deal. And the thing that I was immediately drawn to about Netrunner is the fact that when I draw 5 cards, if I don't like those 5 cards, I can just spend turn after turn after turn just clicking to draw until I find the thing that I need.
Right. So instead of relying on the randomness of the cards that you are dealt, everyone is on a more equal playing field because you are essentially getting an equal number of actions per turn. And then it's how you choose to use those actions that can you know, make up for maybe a bad starting hand or having gotten yourself into a corner. You know, there's a lot more flexibility there, I think.
Yeah, to me, it was just a matter of, no matter how many times I played Netrunner, there was always, I felt like something I could do to be improving my position.
Yes.
And so I felt like I was in control. And I know I'm not. I mean, RNG affects us all. And bad luck is going to affect everyone sometimes. And I mean, I've probably played, I used to keep track of this. I don't anymore. I've probably played the game 6,000 times or
so. Sure.
And I have many, many, many stories of just, oh my gosh, I had 20 cards. I had 20 agenda points in my hand at the end of my first turn, as Waylon was. You know, things like that, where it's just the horror stories that everyone gets when you play enough times. But I don't know. I feel like in comparison to any other game, just the design element of, you can always click for credits, you can always click for cards, just has kept this game really fresh and really interesting to me over 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. So over those 5 years, you've published a couple decks that maybe our listeners might have heard of before. They might kind of know about you as a deck builder without realizing that it's you. So I wanted to draw a little bit of attention to those. I think one of the first big ones that you came out with was a deck called Clicking Hell, which came out right around when Order and Chaos was released in like early 2015. This was a deck that tried to combo Heinlein Grid, which is an upgrade that while you're running, if you lose clicks or spend clicks during your run, you lose all your money. So you combine that with False Lead, the agenda that you can, you know, in any paid ability window, sacrifice to force the runner to lose 2 clicks, and then you would force them to lose all their money during a run. Ideally, while they're about to face plant into some nasty piece of ice. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think the innovation that I brought to it at the time, and it's not a brilliant move by any stretch, but it was an unexpected one that won me a tournament, was people didn't realize that I could use False Lead mid-run to proc Heinlein Grid. Because most people saw Heinlein Grid and said, yeah, but Byroids aren't that good. And if you res it, I'm just not going to break your Eli using clicks. And it's no big deal.
Right. I'll just bounce off the end of the run.
But it happened a few times, and even in kind of the final game of the tournament, where I caught people off guard. They'd run on click 2. I would res an Ichi, I would res the Heinlein Grid, I would say, okay, in the same window, I sack False Lead, and thus you lose all your money, and since you no longer have clicks, I'm just going to go ahead and trash your 2 most valuable programs, I'll give you a brain damage and a tag, and it's my turn. And they'd say, oh, but wow, I wasn't ready for that, I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I think that was at a time in the game, too, when there wasn't necessarily, like, a ton of instant speed actions, maybe particularly on the corp side. I mean, there was self-modifying code and clone chip, so, like, shapers could manipulate programs. But, right. Like, I don't remember a lot of other really fishy things that were going on at instant speed like that. So maybe that was one of the reasons why it was able to catch people off guard. I don't know.
Yeah, and the thing that kind of forced me to put the deck away is once Faust was out, that combo got significantly less powerful. Because people would just say, okay, fine. You cost me my money, but here's a card and here's 3 more cards, and I'm going to break that EG with Faust anyway. And now I'm going to keep on going, and I'm still going to steal your agenda.
Yeah. But yeah.
In its day, it was a fun card. It was a fun deck.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a ton of fun. And a common thread that I see with a lot of the decks that you play, Dane, is that you are using cards that maybe don't see a ton of play, so you're able to surprise people, but by the same token, you're not playing necessarily really terrible cards. And I think you have a good sense of, like, what is a combo that technically, like, works together, but is bad and not an efficient use of my resources, versus, like, a combo that can actually, in the right circumstance, push you a lot further in the back and forth of the game. Shortly after that deck came out, Order and Chaos comes out, and maybe a little bit, I think probably a couple months after that, you come out with Congress Kate, which is basically using an economy engine based out of Underworld Contact. When your turn begins, gain a credit if you have 2 link. And data folding, when your turn begins, gain a credit if you have at least two unused memory. So I love the name of it. Explain to the listener, why do you call it Congress?
Oh, yeah. So the thought process behind naming it Congress was, you know, you work really hard to set up your engine, and then you don't have to do anything. So it was a not so subtle jab at our lawmakers. Seemed to work very, very, very hard at getting elected and making a lot of promises. And then once they are, in fact, in Congress or in the Senate, then they get paid a lot of money and do essentially nothing.
Well, I'm sure that there's not a lot of congressmen and women who are listening to this podcast, so I'm sure you're safe.
Yeah. I would tell it to their faces as well. I think the thing that made Congress the deck that it was, and the reason why I love it so much, it was in the heyday of prepaid cable. So everyone was on Kate, and all of my opponents saw my opener, they saw my ID and said, okay, I'm going to play against prepaid Kate. And they had very real expectations about how to fight that and what types of things prepaid Kate could do and what couldn't. And when I threw them curveball, they looked up the mid game and realized, minute, he's making 5 credits and not spending any clips. Every turn he's making 5 credits.
Right.
And he also has Magnum Opus, and so if he wants to remote camp me, he can just click for 8 more. And unlike a prepaid Kate deck, I can't rely on him having sequencing issues at this point or me just bleeding his money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is just in perpetuity. He's going to be making 5 credits for doing nothing. And so by the time they realized I wasn't on prepaid Kate, they'd often lost the game.
Right, right. Because that end game is so inevitable.
Right.
But if you try to be real tricksy and try to rush out against prepaid Kate, you can get punished because she can bounce from basically no money up to 15 credits with minimal effort and then really punish you for that. So it was kind of playing the exact opposite kind of game as prepaid Kate under the guise of what prepaid Kate was. So,
right.
One last deck that you've made, Dane, that I want to draw some attention to is a... kind of an oddball deck that you call RoboCop, and this came out in the middle of the Mumbad cycle. Yeah. And here you're basically combining a strange asset called Brain Taping Warehouse, where the res cost of Bioroids is reduced by 1 for each click the runner has, with a Surat City Grid, which is a Wayland upgrade. It says whenever you res a card in or in protecting this server, you can res another card, lowering the cost by 2. So the important thing there is that they're both lowering res costs, and if you res something in the Surat City Grid server, then you can res something else that's protecting that server, which then triggers Surat again, so you can res something else in that server. How did you fall upon this combo? This is just so out of left field. I love it.
I mean, Edie from Run Last Click has always been in love with the whole Brain Taping Warehouse pirate deck.
Sure.
And so, you know, like the idea for this type of thing has always been out there. Surat City Grid is kind of a generally underpowered card. It's basically didn't see any play before or since.
well, because you know, it costs 2 credits to res to give you a 2 credit discount, so you already have to res like 6 or 8 things with it to make it a decent economy card.
Right.
You know, and if you have to res something in the server beforehand, before you get the Surat down, then it doesn't do anything.
Right, and it's out of Wayland, and Wayland was kind of historically weak at that point.
Yeah.
You'd still argue whether it still is. I think Wayland's on the up and up. But at the time, Wayland was kind of the weakest.
Yeah.
And so people just looked at it and said, well, it's green. I'm not playing green. I don't need to worry about it. I don't know. I like doing weird things. it's fun to just kind of play some jank. And this was, I went down to Louisville to play in their regional. I got friends down there. I love going down to see Dodd and hang out with the Breaking News crew.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first tournament of the season, and I just thought, you know, there will be other times where I can bring my A game. I think I'm just going to bring this deck, and it will probably lose most of its games, but maybe it will pull off once, and it will be funny, and we'll all have a laugh, because I'll res a Janus for $1. And it will be great. It will be great fun. But instead, it went
5-0. Yeah.
5-0.
Didn't even drop a game.
Ended up making the cut at a tournament. I was just there to goof off. Like,
yeah,
I was thinking I was going to lose right away, and then I was going to probably just drive home to Chicago from there.
Sure. But that's part of the adventure. That's part of the tournament circuit. You never know. Am I coming back for day two? I didn't expect to do that with Surratt City Grid and Heimdall 2, but here we are. So,
you know, but there were a lot of times where I kind of surprised myself, even realizing, man, I just rezzed 2 Heimdall 2s and 2 Janices. And, you know,
it's like firing off 4 priority requisitions all in a row. Like, what?
Yeah. Like, it kind of just created a brand new game in the middle of the game.
Hmm.
Where I was just kind of dirtling and I was falling behind, and I say, haha, look at this weird thing I just did. And we would kind of laugh at it, and then they'd look down and they'd get serious and they'd be like, wait, I actually don't have a way into your R&D for the rest of the game. Like, I literally do not have the breaker suite get in, and you know, I've already taken one brain damage somewhere else, and so I can click through one of those Janices, but the other one would kill me.
Right.
So, okay, there goes my game plan. I got to try something totally new. And the same thing kind of happened for me as well, where I would res it, and I would say, wait, I've been playing catch-up this whole game, and now I suddenly have a remote that I know they can't get through more than once. And they're on 2 points, so I'm going to draw on clicks 1 and 2 and try and find agendas and just jam them. Because if I do, then I know I win. So,
well, and you've got Ash too, right? So, like, the chances of them being able to pay through Janus, Heimdall 1, Heimdall 2 with, you know, what, like, Corroder, I guess? You know, and then beat the Ash Trace or have to run through it again. Like, you know. You're right. Your remote was super secure at that point. So
yeah, and it created a game state that was just kind of unique in the meta at that time.
Yeah,
which I thought was funny. Just why I wanted to do it.
It is still funny to me. listener, you can still make this deck if you want to.
You know, I have made it work since using CI.
Hmm.
With, help me out, the agenda that when you squirt allows you to install as many cards as you want for free.
Successful field test.
Successful field test. Yeah, if you can, like, double biotic a successful field test, and you have all the pieces in your hand, breaks my heart that I no longer have Janus to res. But, I would score a successful field test, I would throw a whole bunch of cards down, and then I would proc the combo at the beginning of the runner's turn. And it was fun because it would go from kind of a standard CI game into a kind of standard Glacier game.
Yeah.
With just one turn difference. People were like, oh, wait, there was only one rezzed ice on the board before, and now there are 6 pieces of rezzed ice, and they are all monsters.
Also, I have to comment, looking at this deck list, it has 2 code gates, 2 Victor 2, and it's because it came out before the Flashpoint cycle, which is when we got all the Fair Children, and now when I go to make an HB deck, like, I struggle to find things that are not code gates to put in there. Because I'm like, why don't I just put in more Fair Children? Why don't I just put in more Ravanas? Like, come on. So
yeah,
that's pretty funny.
We're in a weird state right now where I'm less scared of centuries than I am of any other kind.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Which is bizarre, really.
It's really bizarre. And it really undermines that old adage of, like, slam down a fairy and run because your fairy can break whatever it is, the terrible ice that you hit. And, like, you know, now if you went by that MO, you can hit a DNA tracker and lose 6 credits and 3 net damage. Or you hit a Fairchild and you lose 6 credits and you take a brain or end the run. Or like, that's just terrible stuff.
You hit a Chiyoshi and you take 4 net damage. Or you hit a Pythonium and you lose your rig and best resource. Like,
it's rough times, man. Rough times. And unfortunately, it just means that, you know, you're much more scared to, like, face check stuff. But I also think that a lot of those ice are pretty well costed. So for me, it just makes me look at my opponent's credit pool. Look at the corpse credit pool and say, okay, they've got 8 credits. They could res a DNA tracker. But if they just installed advanced something in the remote, then they're probably not going to because they have to protect that remote. So now is a good time for me to run. You know, making those decisions.
I love that ice is as brutal as it is. I think it's a really nice change of pace from where so much has been before this.
Yeah. Well, now I will look at ice and I'll look at subroutines and say, okay, I've got a limited amount of money because I don't have frickin' Temujin and Blue Moose, so I don't want to spend all my money. And I'm looking at these subroutines, and you know what? Fine. Mausolusk can fire. I don't need these cards, so I'll take a net, and I'll take the tag and break it later. And so then I'll like choose, like, yes, these subs can fire. And that was something that I never did early on in my Netrunner career, because all the subs, like, you just wanted to break them all. They were always relatively affordable to break. And you didn't want those adverse effects. So it's a lot more interesting now when you choose whether or not you want subs to fire, I think.
Absolutely.
So I love the biography. I could write a book on you. I won't, but I could.
But it would be a boring book.
It would be a boring book. So instead, we're going to move on because, Dane, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about runner economies. And we're going to do that in our next segment called Rigonomics. So, Dane, I'm thinking we should probably start with maybe the go-to runner economy packages that we see now. You know, this is after like a full year of being spoiled with Temujin contract, and you didn't have to worry about money anymore. And now we're back to the short rows, I think, and we have to make really intentional decisions for most of our runner decks. So what would you say are like the go-to econ packages we've got right now?
Well, I mean, I think you can start with Magnum Opus, which I think is still a really strong economy package, although it really has to be balanced with the fact that it means you don't get another restricted card.
Oh, yes.
And so, I mean, there are still some shapers. Play Opus. I mean, really great Haley Opus builds.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they'll play Trope. Sometimes they'll play, you know, Turning Wheel and Rip Deal to make sure that they have some amount of recursion, but you know, the loss of Levy is a big deal.
It is.
My favorite place to have Magnum Opus actually is out of the Frantic Coding Anarch builds.
Yeah. Frantic Coding being an event, I think it's 3 cost. You look at the top 10 cards of your deck, you pick one program and install it for a 5 credit discount, which Magnum Opus is 5 credits. So, for free, slam that down, and you trash the other 9 cards. So, very anarchy, super fun, but in a faction that, A, can get a whole bunch of stuff back out of their bin if they ever need it, and B, doesn't necessarily have other tutor options or economy options, like it's a kind of a match made in heaven, you know?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite decks I've ever had, actually. The Frantic Coding Wizard build. Not just viable, but
upon it fondly.
One of the strongest in the meta. So, I mean, I think Magnum Opus is kind of the benchmark for runner econ packaging.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not without significant costs. I mean, you really have to come up with alternatives and backup plans if you're going to run Magnum Opus, because it automatically means you don't get Employee Strike, it means you can't have Clone Chip, it means you can't have Levy. I think it's still excellent. It's still an excellent econ package, but you really have to recognize what you're losing if you choose it.
Yes, yes.
Go with Mopus, get it out, click it, win.
Profit. Done.
Yeah. I think the second archetype would be a heavy event package. Hmm. Ones that I'm thinking of are kind of the children of the prepaid decks. Mm. So when you had prepaid Kate, she only ran event economy. Lucky Find, she ran Sure Gamble, and once those were gone, she would levy and do it all again.
Right.
We still have these builds. You sometimes see them out of like Cantrip Sunny, where she'll run Deuces and Build Script and
Process Automation.
Process Automation.
What's the criminal one? Exclusive Party.
Exclusive Party. Actually, fine. It's not excellent, but at one influence, it makes sense in some builds.
Right.
Will Brown is running
The biggest cost of Exclusive Party is just the slots, right? Because you're essentially getting a very bursty professional contacts type effect where you're getting your one card draw, but then you also get a bunch of money to go along with that. Now it's not, it starts out being zero credits and it gets up to like five, I think. It's not a terrible card. I just never want it because I'm already at 44 or 45 cards, and it's like I don't want to go up to 51. But in Sunny, you got a 50 card deck, so
it's true. And the Cantrip Sunny builds are all about, you know, we're gonna plow through Sunny's 50 card deck, get out a really efficient breaker suite, and then have a few bomb cards like Deep Data Mining, and hope to win on those two or three big things. So the whole purpose of that event-driven deck is plow through as quickly as you can.
Yeah.
I think it's much weaker than it once was, but I still see these types of decks, and I think especially with things like Levy, it might be enough. If you're planning on completing your game just with Peace in Our Time and Three Sure Gamble and Three Day Jobs, you're either going to lose or you're going to spend most of your time just clicking credits. It's not enough. But if you can find ways to recycle your deck again, especially if you're running a Haley or something and you're installing most of your deck on the first run through, these builds are still viable. It's absolutely possible to say I'm going to run a deck with just event econ.
Sure, sure. So because we're kind of talking about a couple shaper or shapery builds, I want to bring up the tapeworm effect that we've seen, particularly since rotation happened. Specifically, Scorpios and Hunter Seeker came out, so people wanted to put in Sacrificial Construct into their decks, and that would prevent like their programs from getting trashed from Hunter Seeker. So then what if you're not up against Scorpios or Hunter Seeker? Well, you want to make the most of SACCON. So then you're going to put in your clot to do the clot lock thing. And then you're maybe looking for something else. And I think that's really when Tapeworm came into popularity.
Yeah. Because Tapeworm is excellent in Criminal, but it's not really an excellent money card. It's more of a tempo card.
It forces them to lose a turn or else give you lots of money. Specifically, the verbiage on tapeworm or tapworm is that it's a virus, so if the corp purges, it gets trashed. so you prevent that with Sacrificial Construct. Then at the start of your turn, you gain 1 credit for every 5 credits the Corp has. So either you're making money or they're losing because they only have 3 credits.
Right. And, I mean, this also combos really well with Peace and Time.
Yes.
It's about the time. And Peace and Our Time was a completely legitimate card, and it was out long before Tapworm, but it didn't see a ton of play until this combo.
Right.
Because if you have a Tapworm down, and then you take 9 credits and give them 5, if they don't spend their next turn purging, that's an extra credit for you that you wouldn't have gotten had you not played Peace.
Right. And so, if you're in Shaper, you may very well also have Beth Kilrain Chang, which also rewards you the more money the Corp has. So you're getting free cards and free credits and free clicks, and then you're getting more credits from Tapworm. So it's like synergy. It's like they were designed to work together.
Yeah. I guess the next main category would just be resources.
Yeah.
I think they kind of get broken up into a couple of types. The ones that most people are going to be familiar with are Liberated Accounts, Daily Casts, and RNG Code Busting.
Yeah.
They have their ups, they have their pros and cons.
Yeah, and plenty of various line graphs to show everyone how they compare, you know, clicks over time, which one is worth more, which one gets you more per click, blah, blah, blah.
Right. I mean, Daily Casts better than Sure Gamble in one way, in that you make 5 credits for that one click and that one card, whereas Sure Gamble only gives you 4. You know, but the disadvantage is you have to wait for it. You get tagged, you either don't want to play it, or it might get trashed. The flip side being that it combos pretty well with Rear Fair. You know, and then you've turned it into a 2-card combo for 8 credits.
Right.
But these aren't really long-term sustainable answers. In those grindy games, you end up having to trash a lot of assets. Playing against a Glacier, you're going to run out.
Yeah, yeah. So then in my mind, the second class of economy resources for Runner would be like your Evergreen options, right? So that's the Congress engine. That would be Underworld Contacts, Data Folding. But then you also wanted to talk about TriMath Contact out of Criminal, right?
TriMath is the 2-cost connection that you can click it to gain 2 credits.
Wow, that's just like Magnum Opus.
It's just like Magnum Opus.
Yeah, but TriMath comes with 2 very distinct disadvantages. The first one being that you can only use it once per turn. So not really like Magnum Opus. But also that if it gets trashed, you take 3 meat damage. So, like, you have to find ways to mitigate that.
So
you lived by the TriMath, and you die by the TriMath. It's a resource, right? So if you're tagged, they can trash you. If you got 2 TriMaths down, they're like, boom, 3 meat, boom, 3 meat, you're dead.
You know, I have died many, many, many times having my TriMath contact trash. but I've also won way more games that I otherwise would have lost.
You know, secretly, this is just between you and me, Dane. Secretly, yeah. TriMath is kind of a good card. Like, economically, it's all that you ever want. You get down 2 TriMath, you can spend 2 clicks every turn, gaining 4 credits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll do that all day.
Yeah.
All right, so we're talking about unlimited resource economy, which means that we have to bring up something that's been a staple since the beginning of the game, which is Aesop's Pawn Shop. At the start of your turn, trash one of your installed cards, gain 3 credits. It's always been really, really good. Noise used it forever. I know it doesn't seem that great on paper because you're kind of destroying your rig, but you're always coupling it with abilities where you wouldn't mind trashing that card anyway. So it's really common to see out of Haley where you're getting an extra install every turn, basically, or
You can put an Apex now because of Assimilator?
Yeah, Assimilator. So Apex is one of those weird mini factions. He's got the stipulation where you can't install non-virtual resources. Aesops is a connection. Therefore, he's a person and not a glob of data on the internet. But Apex just got a new card called Assimilator, which lets you flip his face-down cards face up. So you're not installing them. So it's like a weird workaround. And so now you can get down an Assimilator. You use Apex's ID to like install the, or not install. You are putting Aesop's face down on the table, and then you use Assimilator to flip it face up. And so, boom! Now you got a moneymaker engine.
Yeah, and it's surprisingly good. And the new fact also gave Apex the benefit of Cyber Cipher.
Yeah, great codegate breaker, right? Especially if it's not restricted.
Yeah, when you install it, you have to choose a server, and it's only good on that server. But if you use a simulator to flip it up, it avoids that restriction. And so you just end up with four strength codegate breaker that's one to pump and one to break, and it's usable on all servers. So
yeah,
I still don't think a simulator Apex is Tier 1 by any stretch.
Sure.
But Tier 1.5 and Aesops along with Reaver, along with
Wasteland? Is that
Wasteland,
the one?
It gets out of hand really fast.
Really, yeah. Quite it's very Geist-like. His whole engine ends up being like, trash a card, gain two more card draw, you get four credits, six credits, like, yeah. I'll do that for no clicks every turn, thank you. But I think it's also worth pointing out that there's a lot of other decks in the meta that are using Aesop's Pawn Shop. Trevor of the Chicago meta won a store champ with a deck he called Stove, which was an Aesop's Steve Cambridge deck. And the first time that I played against Trevor with this deck, I was like blown away. I couldn't believe I'd never seen it before because it just makes sense. You've got cash in faction, you throw in some Aesops, and then all the stuff that you would sell to Aesops, you just get back with Steve.
And Harbinger is only one influence, and a lot of the tech cards that kind of make the whole income are also all in faction. And so you can play Drug Dealer, which normally, It's a big ask. Like, Drug Dealer is the card that on the corpse turn you get to draw a card. Start of your turn you pay a credit.
Yeah.
So it's great to set up. The problem is that most criminal decks can't turn it off.
Right.
And when your stack is empty, you still gotta pay that drug dealer. But with this Stove deck, the minute you don't want the drug dealers anymore, you just sell them for a profit. So I think that Aesop's is fertile ground for janksters and non-janksters alike.
Mm-hmm.
When they're sitting down and designing their deck and saying, okay, how can I get enough money to make the rest of my deck work and win?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite parts about it is it rewards you for having inexpensive tech cards. So the specific example in Trevor's deck is he's got a dorm computer because he was expecting to play against CTM and other yellow decks, and they all have all this taggy stuff. So dorm computer basically lets you install it for zero, and then you can choose to make a run with it up to four times, and you avoid all the tags for that run. But if he was playing against HB and didn't expect to see any tags, he might still throw down the dorm computer because he knows that he'll be able to at least sell that for three credits. And he's like, sure, I'll get an easy mark out of this. That's fine. So what are you doing in your Anarch decks?
In my Anarch decks?
Yeah. How do you feel about like a Frantic Max where you use Frantic Coding? It's an Anarch event. You pitch the top 10 cards of your deck and you can install a Magnum Opus or another program for a discount of 5. So you use like Frantic Coding to basically search your deck for Magnum Opus at the cost of, you know, trashing basically 9 other cards.
I did play against a Frantic Coding Mopus deck at the store championship on Saturday, and it was still surprisingly effective. Now, I was able to score a Chronos Project, and then it was basically over.
Really?
He was running...
Oh, Max, probably.
Yeah, it was Max. He was running 3 Tropes and a Rebirth. And so the logic for him was just get set up, use your Rebirth to stop the Max draw, and then shuffle in the cards that you need to win the game as Edward. So I mean, I think that the Frantic Coding Mope is still a viable option in Anarch. I think they're just called Reg Ass Anarch. they actually do rather well with the combination of Event Econ and Liberated Accounts. You can run ShadowNet and Fansight. You can recur Day Job as a one click 10 credit boost, which is
Seems really good.
It's kind of all you need in those Anarch.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Comrades Val deck list that did really well at Worlds and at a couple store champs since then. And the biggest thing that I see is that they're using, they're leveraging some powerful events, kind of like Criminal used to do. So they have a couple indexing knifed and spooned and things like that. And so I think they're trying to win sooner than later. But then they also run Mining Accident, which can give the core bad publicity. And this is, the deck list I'm looking at is out of Val, so they already start with a bad pub. So, you know, I think just making all of your runs cheaper is a form of economy in itself.
Right.
Particularly that permanent economy, the evergreen variety, which is important, because otherwise you're just running daily casts and liberated accounts and hope they don't run out.
Right.
Okay, Dane, talk to me about Cyberdelia. It just came out in January. I think it's really interesting.
It's a 3-cost hardware. It's non-unique, and the first time you break all the subroutines on a piece of ice in a turn, gain 1 credit.
So it's only giving you your credit back, like, once per turn, but you can have multiples of these out. So if you can afford to pay the 3 cost each, I feel like, you know, this could kind of keep you running with this rebate for having made a run and broken some ice this turn.
Cyberdelia, while kind of a big initial investment, really can add up to where you're making a lot of money over the course of a game.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too shabby to get a 3 credit refund on a run you were already going to make.
Right. And that's just it. That's why Desperado was always so good. It's what you were going to do anyway. Okay, so I've also seen Cyberdelia used with Multithreader. So you're basically, you know, Multithreader gives you those 2 recurring credits for programs. So then you just use those to break, and then you turn that into real cash with the Cyberdelia refund.
And Multithreader, I think, is kind of an underutilized card. You know,
the numbers on it are great.
It's only 1 influence. It's, you know, 3 to install, but it's 2 credits that you can use, recurring credits every turn.
Yeah.
For programs.
At the cost of having, it takes up a memory slot.
Right.
But Cyberdelia gives you a memory slot.
Yeah. The deck kind of builds itself there, where if you throw on a multi-threader and a Cyberdelia, you're basically getting 3 credits to make runs every turn, which that changes the math on breaking ice pretty dramatically.
Yeah.
And I think that that's going to be a really common include in Shapers going forward. It's a couple slots to slot the Cyberdelia, and it's expensive enough that I think we'll probably start to see more modded.
Yeah, that's one of my pet cards for sure. I've always liked modded. It just feels good.
Yeah, I mean, it stinks when you end up with a modded and nothing to use modded on, but especially right. with professional contacts or even Velasco, Shaper Draw is really solid. And, you know, I think that modded more often than not pays for itself. I know that there are other economy cards that we didn't specifically talk about, but there's one more I want to talk about just because I have been recently playing it as my fun jank deck.
Ooh, okay.
And that is a card called Windfall. And Windfall, in normal circumstances, is really bad.
It's the hottest of garbage, if you ask
yes.
me.
Yes. Because it's a zero-cost event. You have to shuffle your deck, and then you trash the top card of that deck, and you gain credits equal to the install cost of that card.
Oh, God, that's right. So you have to shuffle first, so you can't, like, be cool and look at the top card of your deck with some other card
right.
that would let you do that.
You kind of just have to hope that your deck is either full of expensive cards or find some other shenanigans to make it work.
Right. Man, I feel like that would be really good if you could somehow, like, guarantee that, like, the next three cards in your deck were, like, these really expensive installables, and
right.
then you just got to play, like, three Windfall in a row.
So that's the, you kind of... It's like you've seen this deck before, Gray.
Yeah, I did. Yep.
Yeah. So the package I've been including, so I've been playing it out of CT, so that I only have to burn through my deck of 40 cards rather than 45 cards.
Yeah.
But in addition to kind of a standard normal Shaper deck, I found space for three Windfalls, two Trope, and three Monolith. So Monolith is the 18 credit, unplayably bad console, which you never want to install.
Creation and control, man. It's never even going to rotate.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's atrocious and it's useless, except as the fact that it has an 18 top left corner. And so the whole point of the deck is I'm using professional contacts to draw through. I'm playing a normal standard Shaper with my SMCs and my, you know, my Atman and my standard breakers, and I'm just playing against the Corp as I normally will. But I will also install a Trope three turns before I know I'm going to be out of my deck. And sometimes I'm just trying to burn through my deck and I have Laguna Velasco District down, and so I can count through and say, yeah, I can burn through these last 20 cards in the last three turns. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to install my Trope, and I'm just going to spend the next three turns just drawing through my deck and discarding eight cards every turn.
Mm-hmm.
You pop Trope. You have to shuffle in as many cards as you have counters. And Trope does not say up to, and so you really have to time it properly.
Ah, okay.
Because if you get distracted and you end up with that fourth card, that fourth counter on Trope, when you trash it, you have to shuffle a fourth card in, even though you don't want to. But when you shuffle in three Monoliths, and that's your whole deck, when you play Windfall, yes, you have to shuffle those three cards, but it's
going to
be Windfall every time.
Right.
And so I've been having fun with this package, you know, realizing that I'm giving up eight card slots. And I mean, giving up those eight card slots for cards that are not going to help me until mid to late game.
Yes.
And I know that. I've never installed a Monolith. I have no intention of it.
Yeah,
it's
I think that
atrocious.
List, isn't it like, it's like three Monolith, and then there's also like the Gauntlet? Like, the Monolith is not your console.
No, it is not my console. I am running real consoles. Yeah, I have a Gauntlet, because I think Gauntlet is excellent in Shaper.
Yeah,
I don't need more than one Gauntlet because, again, I'm plowing through my whole deck.
Yeah.
And so that's the other upside to this weird economy package, that I'm able to,
you know, so
slot a whole bunch of one-ofs.
We were playing each other at the GNK just a week or so ago, and, you know, I'm seeing you draw with your professional contacts, and I'm like, okay, it's going to be kind of a mid-range Shaper deck, I can just focus on scoring out, and he's probably not going to challenge me that much. And then you get down to Laguna Velasco District, and I said, that's weird. You know, usually you don't see those together. But then I kind of, like, stopped paying attention to what you were doing, because I was really focused on, like, okay, I should be able to score out here pretty shortly. And then you put your third trope counter on, and you say, okay, I'm going to pop trope here, and we're going to shuffle in these guys. And then my turn's going to be windfall. My entire deck is just monoliths, and then I'm gonna levy. And I said, wait, what? You're gonna? And you're like, yep. So I gain what is that? 54 credits. And I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, gaining 54 credits in a turn is pretty good. Now, in hindsight, after playing this deck, I think that I probably got a bit greedy. I don't really need 3 Windfall and 3 Monolith. I probably don't need to, like, aim my entire deck at this one moment. I think it would be better just as a much more standard shaper. But I like to see all of these things as kind of things I can port in. I can say, what's this package that I want? What kind of econ package do I want? You know, do I want to go with the resources and career fairs? Okay, I don't have much influence. I'm not drawing that fast. Okay, maybe I will just include Magnum Opus and 3 SMC. Or, you know what, I think I want an artist colony so that I can get some more consistency out of this deck. So I'm going to be playing 3 fan sites. You know what, I'm also going to include a Shadow Net and a day job, because Shadow Net is still going to get me some great money from those fan sites.
Yeah.
So I don't think that Windfall is going to be the next big craze, but after having built a jank deck for the whole purpose of just saying, you know what, I'm just going to aim my entire deck at earning 54 credits in one turn, I think the package of a trope, a monolith or two, and a windfall, it might actually be a 4 or 5 card combo that's worth putting into other decks.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, just shaper decks. I don't think this really works if you have to pay influence for a monolith. But
no. I know a lot about random Netrunner cards. You know a lot about, you know, like you've got the Rolodex in your mind of like what the different Netrunner cards are. Pretty much no one offhand can tell you what the influence on Monolith is, because no one ever wants to import Monolith.
Yeah, I don't think it's ever been imported. I don't imagine it's ever been worth anyone's while. Because really, just including Monolith is gonna get your deck labeled jank, no matter what else it's doing. But
yes.
I don't know. I wanted to talk about the Windfall discovery, just because, I mean, I build these jank decks because I think they're funny when they pop off.
Right, right.
But in playing that, I mean, really, all of my favorite decks, talked about in my biography, a lot of them were kind of jank adjacent when they started out.
Oh, yeah.
And they were things that were jank, except for the fact that they worked. And
right.
Once they work, they get upgraded into, okay, they're not jank. It may be weird, you're running some different combos, but because it works, we're going to upgrade it into
this is just
a combo deck. It's no longer a jank deck, it's a combo deck.
Right, like Brain Rewiring CI. Yeah, okay, that's when Brain Rewiring came out, you could make the CI deck, but you're like, nah, that's pretty janky, I don't think I'm going to try to do that. But then it got second place at Worlds, and people said, oh, okay, yeah, that's the Brain Rewiring CI. That's a thing. I mean,
right.
It's pretty janky, but still, if it works.
Yeah.
You know, when I first started getting into Netrunner more, instead of just playing occasionally with my friends at the kitchen table, just loved exploring all these different combos, and I once I was like starting to get really involved and following all this stuff, I kind of viewed myself as sort of this explorer, right? Because, you know, at any given point, you look online and you see what the popular decks are, and, you know, maybe you think those are cool, maybe you think that they're trite because that's what everyone's playing. That's definitely how I was. I was, like, way Netrunner hipster. And so I decided I would rather spend my time trying to explore and find the synergies that hadn't been tapped into yet, and explore those and see if I could be on, like, the front edge of, like, the explored meta. I don't know if you ever have felt like that, but, like, that was the most fun for me when I was first getting into the game.
So, well, I guess we didn't talk about this in my biography, but this is the story of my Netrunner career in T, is that when I first started, you know, I was going to these meetups and I was playing against these people who I'd never played against, and I was the noob. But they had already kind of tested all of these strategies that were brand new to me. So I didn't really make friends with them right away. Like, I only talked to them a couple times, and right away, within 2 months or so, there was a regional, the first regional in 2013, and I brought Replicating Perfection,
which at the time was not considered to be very strong.
No. So everyone in the meta around here had picked it up. They had done with it what they thought they were going to, what was going to be good. And it just wasn't there because there was no money and there was no good ice. Jinteki ice was garbage.
So bad. Genesis Jinteki ice was so bad.
Yeah. But I hadn't seen it. I hadn't explored it. And so I was too dumb to realize that it didn't work. And so I built a deck where I imported a bunch of money, played Melange, I played Marked Accounts, I played Pad Campaign. I basically just played every money card in the game. And then I used all of the rest of my influence on big, scary ice. So I played a Janus. I played an Ouroboros.
Oof.
Which is kind of crap, but when you have more money than them by a lot,
the traces are good.
It's pretty good. And an RP, they have to run a central before they can run a remote. And so when I would res an Ouroboros and say, hey, I have 30 credits. You don't have enough credits to break this. So I'm just going to make this a trace 10 to make sure that you are not allowed to run on my remote this turn. Hey, surprise, I just got to score my priority requisition. Hey, look, I just got to res a Janus for free. So I played in a meta where basically everyone was on either Tag and Bag Wayland or HB, Fast Advance HB, because that was the deck. And the way the scoring worked, you were highly motivated to just get any points you could. Because,
oh, that's right.
Only one person got points per round, and it was whoever won. If you either won both games, then you won the match, or if you split the match, whoever scored more points won the match, and the other person was just out of luck.
Right.
And so, in a meta where the runner was dominant, people were playing HB. Because the difference of fast advancing out that Vitruvius may be the thing that won them the match.
Sure.
Because they won their runner game 7-0, but then once they fast advanced out that first agenda, even if they lost 7-2, they were still going to win the match. So you could stop. So in a meta where runner was just dominant, you had Noise Shop and you had Criminal who just ran rampant because there was no real siphon defense. I went, I think it was 4-1 with my corp.
Wow.
So I was one of the few people who had even just a winning record with my corp, let alone to win almost every game. And wow. the only game I dropped was to my friend Ben Proctor, and it's because he and Katie had been testing, and they'd been playing RP. So Katie brought RP to the tournament as well. So Ben had helped her build the deck. He knew how to play it and how to play against it. So he was the only one who wasn't bamboo. Everyone else looked at it and said, RP, all right, easy win.
And okay, then, and move over, Jank.
And then they'd get brained, or I would res a Hourglass. And they'd lose all their clicks, and then they couldn't run my room. So, I mean, I was playing a bad version, or a bad version of what we all came to know as the RP deck, you know, that Dan D'Argenio won Worlds with.
Yeah.
But I was doing it in the spring of 2013, and so no one was ready for it.
Right.
And so I kind of lucked into that one just being kind of too ignorant and too naive to know that it was a bad deck, and so it became a good deck. And so since then, I've always been on the lookout, like you, for these kind of underappreciated combos.
Yeah.
And to see where I can steal some wins by being a little bit counter meta.
Yes. And Netrunner is a great game because it, although it will almost always reward skill, like that's how someone like Dan D'Argenio makes the cut at Worlds almost every year, but...
And has been won 2 years in a row with very different decks.
It also is a hidden information game, and there are cards that, in the right situation, if you can surprise your opponent, or if you make a really great meta call, then yeah, you can get wins where you might not have otherwise had them. And that's why I think it's such a great hobby, because it rewards you for following along with the meta, and you know, there's such a huge card pool, so when you kind of put together this giant brain meld of all these ideas of these different players, like, you get a really diverse, interesting game to follow.
Yeah. So,
and I always like highlighting that play style as opposed to the competitive play style, because I think the competitive side of the game gets a lot of attention, as well it should, because it's a competitive card game. But there's a lot of different ways to enjoy Netrunner. And I like winning games with cards that are not that common. There's other people who love finding crazy jank decks and just finding ways to sometimes pull off that combo, and that's really rewarding too. And that's also very valid. So it's a cool game. That's why we're talking about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great for those people who, there's a lot of people who just don't really enjoy the deck building aspect. And I think a lot of the really excellent players, some of them are excellent deck builders, but a lot of them, the reason why they consistently win is they can take decks that other people make and just pilot them perfectly. They just, they're smart enough to kind of know all the decision points. They know all of the interactions. They know all of their matchups, and they make the ideal decision in each moment. For me, I saw these people and said, you know what? I can do that fairly well, but I don't think I can do that in a top flight way.
Mm.
I don't think I'm a tier one player, as Damon would call them, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of, there are hundreds and hundreds of people who are going to make those decisions better and more consistently than I will. But I like to play things that I can play well that other people can't play well against me, because it's a little bit off the beaten path.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the great equalizer, to where I can play against people and I can keep the Worlds this year. There's way more than 18 people who are better than me at this game. There were more than 18 people who were better than me at this game at that tournament.
Yeah.
And yet I was able to kind of steal wins off of people who, hands on the cards on the table, they are better players than I am.
Sure.
But I was able to beat them in large part because I was just approaching it from a slightly diagonal angle.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to talk about Runner Econ today, and why I wanted to explore this. I think economy is such a fertile ground for looking through the whole thing, finding an econ package that works for you and works for the type of gameplay you want to do and deck style that you want to make work. And I think that there's a lot more flexibility in it than often gets displayed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, like you said, some people don't enjoy the deck building process. And so when they go to grab a deck, or if they are trying to build a deck, they're going to gravitate towards whatever that economy package is that they are familiar with. Oh, I know that this is right. something that worked in this other deck, so I'll just try and smash it in here. And but there, you know, there's a lot of options out there. So, you know, there's some hidden gems in the rough. You made an interesting point, too. You played RP at a regional, and then a year and a half later, it ends up winning Worlds. And then you made this Congress engine, but then 6 months later, Sunny comes out, and it's basically the same economy engine. And then you make this Surratt brain taping pre-res Bioroids economy engine, and then 6 months later, Architects of Tomorrow comes out. So, Dane, my question for you is, what are you playing now so I know what is going to be good this summer?
or
at least what ID is going to come out this summer.
Oh, man. Well, I'm blushing now at that, the way you frame that. But yeah, maybe Windfall is going to be the new hotness.
Right? They're going to release some card that lets you, I don't know, it rewards you for playing Windfall in your deck or something, and you're like, wait a second.
Yeah, I don't think that I'm the the canary in the coal mine for where the meta is going. I think I just I think that those examples you cite are situations where I see the first part of the combo, where I see where the designers are already planning on going.
Yeah.
And I try and make it work even though the whole combo hasn't come out yet.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, once the full combo is released, I kind of get bored of it. And I say, I'm going to go on to the next thing. And right. That's partly just me being a contrarian. But
yeah.
So I don't know. I'm not sure where the future of the meta is going. But that's right. What I'm on.
Well, I'll keep playing you. And I'll keep that way. I keep my fingers on the pulse, right? And then I will know, and I will know everything, and that will help me win. Maybe I don't know.
Nice. All right. Cool.
Well, Dane, that's all I got, man.
Cool. Thanks, Graham.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining me. Coming on the show.
Yeah.
All right. So now here's all the stuff that I say at the end of the podcast. Oh, before I do, listener, I am looking to you to send in your ideas for discussion questions and topics, things that you want to hear myself and my guests talk about. So if you have any ideas, you can send it my way to any of the following contact information. You can find us at least twice a month at shipmentfromshiloh.podomatic.com. You can shoot me a tweet at GrahamCrackerGo. My username on all things Netrunner is PureFlight. Thanks to Foundation for the amazing theme music, and thanks to you for listening in. That's our show. This is Graham Carlson signing off for the night. Stay safe, New Angeles, and join us next time on Shipment from Shiloh. I'm your host, Graham, and today I am joined by one of the Netrunner greats, Dane. Whoa, man, hold on. I gotta start this over, because I just knocked my microphone off my desk.
Nice. Yeah, too excited.
Got too excited.